for people to reach forward, you know, to believe that they can have another chance. As we all know, that the backlog of clemency positions runs into tens of thousands.
Reynolds, how did you get the clemency? You'd already been in jail for what, like 18 years?
Yes. Well, the process began long before I even filed paperwork. I worked for a lady in the education department. Her name was Janice Feaster. I was a tutor, and you know, we had dialogue, and a guy, Pryor Reed, President Bush had pardoned him. He had a life sentence. He had been in prison for 8 years. And so when we said, when she told me what happened with him, because he worked with us as a leisure library clerk, she told me that, why don't you file for clemency? Your story is a different kind of story. And you know, at the time, you know, facing all the things from my own past and still being held accountable for it, you know, it was hard for me to see, why would they give me another chance? You know, I had faced issues in prison, such as classes. Okay. And so it was a process. I'm glad that I had a great support group. And then I had an attorney, my angel Cody, that said, yes, she would help me.
Well, we will continue to follow what happens this week with President Obama being the first sitting president to visit a prison, that in Oklahoma. Reynolds Wintersmith and Cynthia Roseberry, thanks so much for being with us. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Robbie Caron, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Elizabeth Press. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8 o'clock. Coming up next is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with our hosts Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. Today, we'll debunk some popular conservative mythology, such as taxing the rich hurts poor folk.
Should it be harder for landlords to evict their tenants for no reason at all?
Should safe and healthy homes come before the interests of private investment?
Is the rent too damn high?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, join us for the next Portland Renters Assembly.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right.
The next two assemblies are on Sunday, July 12th, from 12 to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library, with speakers on how race intersects with gentrification.
And on Wednesday, July 15th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park, with speakers on community organizing and mobilizing.
Tell your story and join the conversation. For more information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
Attention, KBOO members. You are invited to give your feedback on KBOO's draft mission and vision statements. Based on member feedback from the recent survey and member retreat, KBOO board and staff members created draft mission and vision statements. Now we want to know what you think. This is your chance to help define KBOO's guiding principles and priorities. Visit KBOO.fm to review the draft mission and vision statements and submit your comments. Paper copies of the draft statements are also available at the station. Comments are due July 17th. If you have questions, please contact Monica Beamer at monica@kboo.org. Thank you for contributing to the development of KBOO's mission and vision statements and for your support of community radio.
I'm a loving the old line.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the PDX Leo Party, Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympian. A birthday celebration for all you Portland Leos with special performances from Sleep of Old Dominion and the Chicharrones, Mike Crenshaw, Smoke M2D6, and many more. Again, that's the PDX Leo Party on Friday, July 31st, starting at 8 p.m. at Kelly's Olympian, located at 426 Southwest Washington Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Tom Dwyer Automotive Services. a full-service automotive shop located next to Portland's Selwood Bridge for over 30 years. They're a Blue Seal certified shop committed to client care and community support. Information on their eco certification, client carbon neutral program, courtesy shuttle, rentals, and more at tomdwyer.com or by calling 503-230-2300.
Some people say a man is made out of mud, but a poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones, with the mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? You get another day older and deeper in debt. Say, Saint Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. Well, I was born one morning, it was drizzling rain. Fighting and trouble are my middle name. Raised in a canebrake by an old mama lion. Can't no high-toned woman make me walk the line. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? You get another day older and deeper in debt. Saint Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
You know.
Now what? What do I know?
Well, when I was 16 years old.
You know nothing, Jon Snow.
When I was 15 or 16 years old, this song came out, Tennessee Ernie Ford version of the song.
Uh-huh.
It was the first kind of working class song that,
really?
That hit the pop market at
you
that time.
You must have heard it live because there wasn't recorded music yet.
Well, you're so wrong. You're so silly.
Okay.
Anyway, I was introduced to it by a fairly sophisticated high school student woman who said, you know, you need to check this out. And she'd already identified me as one of those people that tended toward a politics of what was left wing, mm-hmm. even perhaps
commie,
yeah. proletarian, right. that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. Well. What's interesting is that right now what we're seeing in America is that coal is losing place to fracked natural gas, that in fact the whole market for energy is changing.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meanwhile, something else is looming more and more quickly in our sights. And what that is basically an argument that American workers are lazy. And that they need to work more. And you're going to talk a little bit about that. But I want to remind people that this is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. This is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. And that's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. Yep. The number to call, 231-8187.
You can also leave a comment on our Facebook page if you don't feel like talking quite yet this early in the morning. That's at facebook.com/Abe and Joe.
So,
what are we talking about today?
Well, as far as I can tell, we're talking about Jeb Bush.
Yeah, well, yes and no, because I really don't want to talk about presidential candidates at this point, because that's like 18 months away, or well, not a little less than that now.
Yeah,
it's more than a year away, right? We don't need to be talking. Engineer Steve says, yeah, we can profile one candidate per month from
Scott
now until
Walker,
the other.
Scott Walker.
No.
Busting labor.
But Jeb Bush happened to say something.
Yes,
recently
did.
that has led us to the subject of today's topic. There's two cornerstones of conservative economic ideology. And I say ideology because that's what it is. It's not science. It's not grounded in fact. Do you know what those two cornerstones are?
Tell me, what are those two cornerstones, Abe?
Joe, I'll tell you what they are. The first is the notion that the economy does better when the rich pay fewer taxes.
Well, everyone knows that.
Right, because they are the job creators.
Everyone knows that.
And if they are taxed less, that extra money will somehow trickle down.
Trickling down.
To the middle and lower classes.
Which is why so many homes are moldy.
And this rising tide of trickling stuff will raise all boats.
Well, there's a metaphor that needs a killing.
Yeah, it certainly does. Because something's trickling down, but it ain't money.
Yeah.
Okay. This is what's known as traditionally as supply side economics.
Okay. What's the other thing?
The other thing is what you mentioned at the outset. This myth that something close to a majority of Americans are lazy.
Yeah.
Who don't work, who are on the dole,
yeah.
who live because of the extraordinary efforts of the industrious other half of the country.
Right. And that, of course, flies in the face of when you exclude countries like China and Vietnam and other countries where workers are have few rights or none and work very, 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 very hard. When you exclude those countries, when you talk about the Western, particularly the Western countries, with the exceptions of places like South Korea and other countries like that, you discover that, in fact, workers, for example, in Western Europe work fewer hours. Mm-hmm. have 4 weeks typically of vacation. The American average is 2 weeks if you have a job that's good enough to give you vacation. That in fact, American workers work harder, work longer hours, earn less money per hour relative to the cost of living, and that in fact, we are behind Western Europe.
Significantly behind.
Yeah.
By a large range of economic measures.
Right. And we don't have decent health care still. Even
precisely.
With Obama, yeah.
And that is a huge drain on American economic production as well.
Right.
But I want to focus today on those two myths of conservative economics.
Okay.
Because they endure despite mountains and mountains of evidence to the contrary. They persist. Why? Because they benefit those that espouse them. You would think after a period of time, with confronted with enough empirical evidence, that somebody would, a rational person, would abandon a belief that is contravened by the real world.
Well, I don't know. No, you wouldn't think so. Look at religion. Look at all the things people believe that have no real reason or fact.
Well, certainly. Yeah, but let's set aside religion because I think that's sort of a special case.
Okay.
That's worthy of its own discussion. I understand what you're doing here. But speaking of economics, it's very easy to look back at history and refute the statement, for example, that everybody prospers, that the middle class is strengthened, that more people move out of the lower class into the middle and working classes when taxes on the rich are lowered. That simply isn't the case. You cannot point to any period in modern American history when this is the case. Not even the glorious days of St. Ronnie the Reagan.
Well, yeah, the Ronnie the Reagan really institutionalized these notions.
He did.
There was Loeffler and there was Murray.
Arthur Laffer.
Laffer, yes.
Yeah, economist from Los Angeles.
Right.
He came up with something infamously called the Laffer curve, which right. allegedly proved that when marginal tax rates are lowered, particularly upon the wealthy, that the increased economic output by the wealthy would raise overall tax revenues. This is something that should have been laughable on its face of the Laffer curve.
Yes.
But instead it's been embraced as holy writ by conservative politicians, by conservative business people.
Well, and then you have, you know, there's a whole ideology here. It's Murray. Remember Murray?
Yeah, I remember Murray.
Who essentially argued in his first major book that black people, persons of color in general, were less intelligent, innately less mm-hmm. intelligent than European Americans.
Yeah, and I think Jeb Bush is on record as being a fan of Murray's.
Oh, yeah, he is, definitely. Now, Murray came out with a new book, which essentially says American workers are too lazy.
Right. So these two myths form the backbone of conservative economic myth. Neither of them are true, but they have persisted. And we're going to argue over the course of this program today, they have persisted to the detriment of all of us. Let's look at a few numbers.
Okay.
Shall we?
Let's look at some numbers.
The first is the growth in productivity since the late 70s in the American workplace. This is essentially since the time that computers became widespread in American industry, in the office, on the job, the construction site, and so on and so forth. The automation of various calculations and such. Since 1979...
Wait, we're not using slide rules anymore?
No, we're not.
Oh.
No, we got rid of abacuses.
Oh, abacai? The abacuses, abacai?
I don't know. We don't have those. Well, they're around, but they're like in museums and stuff.
Well, or in small shops.
Right.
Hither and yon.
Right. Since 1979, American productivity has grown by somewhere around 80%.
Really?
Yes.
No, seriously, 80%.
According to this group, this graph I'm looking at from Mother Jones, yes.
Mother Jones, oh, wow.
Yeah. I've heard other figures there. But suffice it to say that Americans are far more productive now than they were in 1979.
Okay.
We're getting more work done in a shorter period of time.
Yeah.
One would presume that this increase in productivity is resulting in a larger economic yield. And it's true. More wealth is being created because Americans are more productive.
So American workers are better off?
No.
Oh.
American workers are worse off.
Huh.
Virtually all of this extra wealth created by the gain in productivity since the late 70s has gone to the 1%.
I am shocked, simply shocked.
So Jeb Bush says, instead of looking for ways to reclaim the wealth that has been stolen from workers,
Yeah.
Because of these productivity gains, he says, no, the answer is that Americans need to work longer hours.
You know, I just want to insert one thing. I'm going to interrupt your flow for just a second.
Okay.
I was taking a walk with an old friend of mine yesterday, and you know, we were talking, and he said, well, he thinks that Social Security, the start of Social Security, should be much later, 75, something like that, because after all, people live longer. And I said, you know, have you ever dug a ditch? You know, have you ever worked in a coal mine? Have you ever driven a truck? Have you ever done any physical labor over a long period of time? It's tiresome, it's tiring, and it wears the body out. But he didn't identify with that. He saw the idea that, gosh, Social Security is eating up money, and then you know, and that. What basically is happening is a huge number of otherwise very intelligent people are buying into these right-wing ideological notions. And it's kind of scary. It's really scary.
It is kind of scary. Mostly scary because they have no basis in fact. It is a fallacy to claim that the economy does better when the rich pay fewer taxes. In fact, the opposite is true. At those times in the industrial age, when we have taxed the upper crust at the highest rate, mm-hmm. The middle class has been the strongest. I'm looking at the post-war decades in particular.
Right.
So it's really easy to refute these things, and they have been refuted again and again, but they are still accepted as holy writ by the right. And we have the presumptive Republican nominee for president embracing them.
Well, Bush.
Right.
Never worked a day in his life. I'm sorry. Right. Physical labor.
Right. It's true.
Well, maybe in high school. Anyway, here's an article that I believe is planted in the New York Times today, very day, right after the Bush argument. Incidentally, by the way, today is July 14th. It's Bastille Day.
Hmm.
Just to make a note. It says, do Americans need to work more? It's possible. It's an article by Josh Barrow, and essentially it is, I swear, it's a planted article to support the notion that American workers are lazy.
Why do you presume that it's planted?
Because it has no basis in fact.
Oh.
And it was just stuck in the front section of the New York Times. Well, maybe it wasn't planted. They just decided to run it by accident.
You know, I'm sort of glad you mentioned that. Because part of the reason that these myths persist is that there has been an unwillingness by the journalistic establishment to challenge these myths with fact. It would be a relatively easy thing to do. And some outfits have done that. Mother Jones is one that I cited earlier. But it really hasn't happened in any sort of mainstream way. The reasons for this, there's possibly many, many reasons for this. But I'm guessing it has something to do with the fact that the people who espouse these myths are the ones who benefit the most from them and are willing to investigate significantly in the media properties that they own to make sure that these sorts of contradictions never make it out into the public eye.
Go back to your stats. I mean, I didn't mean to interrupt the flow of that. I just thought it was important to realize this.
I have some more, and I think we'll touch on them as appropriate in this conversation. Well, okay. Why don't we go to the phones?
Yeah, let's go to the phones.
Who do we have? Sean, good morning.
Hey, good morning, guys.
What's on your mind?
Hey, Barbara Ehrenreich once made the argument, and I definitely agree with her, that the poor and working class are actually the greatest philanthropists in our country. Normally, people think of people like Phil Knight or Bill Gates as philanthropists. But if you think about it, American workers who tolerate a miserly social safety net, who tolerate jobs that pay, if they're lucky, a couple bucks over minimum wage, they are the greatest philanthropists in the country because they basically are subsidizing through their cheap labor. They're subsidizing the McMansions, the private jets, the massive yachts and all this stuff. And so flexible labor markets are actually insanely profitable and represent a kind of philanthropy from the poor and working class to the already rich. Now, what I've been fascinated with lately is this whole concept of leverage. Richard Wolff, the economist, has made the argument that American workers are in a real tight spot because no longer are we needed as workers, thanks to all these free trade agreements, but we're also not even needed as consumers anymore. So that puts us in quite a bind, because if American corporations can sell overseas now and they don't even need our labor, then we become a kind of superfluous population. And so that's what's bringing me more and more to a, almost like a Stalinist point of view, because it seems to me that we need to have some sort of wholesale general strike. I mean, we literally need to have a tough party line that is willing to have harsh discipline and shut this country down. And if you guys can see how we can gain leverage in some other way, I'd really like to hear it, because it seems to me that these quote-unquote flexible labor markets just represent a kind of perpetual slavery for the poor and working class of this country. So you guys take it from there.
Well, I think you're making, I think you're making a really good, really scary but good set of points. And I think it's important to understand that more and more of the working population doesn't work 40-hour weeks, particularly younger people. They work part-time. If they're lucky, some employers give them benefits, but many don't. That essentially we're still at a place where the majority of basic workers don't even earn what they need to survive. That $15 minimum has not been reached by the majority of workers. Some are adjusting for it.
A pretty substantial majority.
Yeah, yeah. So what we're really looking at is a working class, and by the way, I hate the expression middle class in this context, because it's not the middle class, it's working people, working class people. There was a time, which you've mentioned, in the post-war era, in the late 40s, the 50s, the 60s, and into the 70s, when working people earned a decent living. When they could, through various resources, buy automobiles, buy houses, live a decent life, send their children even to public colleges and so on. This is over. Universities, public schools, even community colleges cost a lot of money. Students come out of school in great debt, which is interesting because it puts them in a position where, for example, let's say you go to law school or medical school, you're going to be in such debt that you can't afford to work for Doctors Without Borders or for the ACLU or something. You've got to get a job in a law firm or in a medical service that absolutely pays back your debt. And the same is true for almost any other job you could name. The pattern here, and I think, you know, people don't like to talk about this, but I think the pattern is, as our previous caller suggested, a system that is creating a highly dependent and absolutely endangered working class who don't really serve the function of consumers anymore. We talk about supply, but we never talk about demand, who really are marginalized because in a great world market, we can't compete, particularly against totalitarian states like China or Vietnam. We can't compete in those markets, and anybody who wants to make more money now, especially with the potential passage of the various changes in the international law on trade, it looks to me like we are going to be a nation that will be, if we're lucky, on the dole.
If we're lucky.
If we're lucky. Yeah. But we don't have a dole because our ideology is not social democratic. Our ideology is rugged, so-called rugged individualism.
Right. Which leads people like Mitt Romney and Jeb Bush to claim that a large chunk of Americans, almost half, are in fact on the dole and in fact lazy. You remember Mitt Romney's infamous 47% comment, right?
Yeah, right.
47% of Americans don't pay any taxes, he said, which is, of course, false. 47% of Americans, and that number has come down since he made that statement, pay no federal income tax for a variety of reasons. Most of those households who don't pay federal income tax are either elderly or they earn too little. The Earned Income Tax Credit, for example, which is a remarkably successful anti-poverty program created by Republicans, no less, accounts for a large chunk of those households that don't pay federal income tax. But to say that those people don't pay taxes is false on its face. Most of those households work. Most of them pay into payroll taxes for things like Social Security and Medicare. Most of them pay sales taxes. They pay state and local income taxes. If they own property, they pay property taxes, and on and on and on. So this suggestion somehow that a single mom working full-time at a minimum wage job who still qualifies for the earned income tax credit is somehow not carrying her weight, who is somehow lazy, is not only false, it's insulting. Yeah. Why do these people hold so many of their countrymen and women in such contempt?
Well, I think it's really interesting. I mean, you mentioned women in their situation. It's particularly interesting in that the same ideologues who argue for this right-wing point of view are also against the right of women to control their reproduction. So in essence, you're saying you must, as a woman, you must not enter into sexual relationships with men, and you must not have children. And you must do that without contraception or the right to an abortion.
Right. And if I'm a wealthy religious business owner and you work for me, I'm not going to provide you with a contraception as part of your health care package because it violates my religious freedom. If
Scott
you're
Walker.
Out having sex with whomever you please for whatever reason you please.
Yeah.
So it even turns the most inexpensive of activities, sex, into a privileged activity that poor people shouldn't indulge in. Because they can't afford the consequences.
And, of course, that to say that that's a moral imperative doesn't say anything about the behavior of real people in the real world.
No, it does not.
Okay, well, let's go to the phones again.
Who do we have, Steve?
231-8187. Who do we got? Juan?
Juan, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, guys. So, do you remember this guy? He said something about voodoo economics.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was George Bush the Smarter, I believe.
Well, yeah, smart is going too far.
Smarter.
Go ahead, man.
Okay. Yeah. I say George Bush the brighter, but barely.
But we digress. Go ahead.
So anyway, do you remember the Saturday Night Live when John Lovett would go, yeah, that's the ticket?
Yes, yeah, the pathological liar.
He had
just
heard a lie, and he knew it was a lie, but he was deciding to go with it. And these guys, you know, people give them a pass. Well, they really believe it. They really believe it. BS, I don't think they really believe it. They know it's BS, but they know this is what they're going to use to get us to fall for what they want to do.
Yeah. No, I think that's absolutely true. And I think when you look at the general media, most older Americans who get any news at all get their news from Fox News, which is a bizarre collection of ignorant people who are physically attractive who simply lie at the direction of Ailes.
Yeah.
Roger Ailes. Who is, like, whose campaign manager?
Really?
Wasn't he Bush's campaign manager?
Roger Ailes? No. I think he went farther back with his involvement in politics. I want to say Nixon, but I could be wrong about that.
No, I think you're wrong about that. But but Ailes is part of a vast, I will call it a conspiracy of the right to essentially legitimize a system which gathers most wealth at the top makes us all feel cool about it.
You don't even have to say, conspiracy. They're propagandists. That's all.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Anyway, thanks for the call, man.
That's all I got.
Okay. Thanks, sir.
Thank you very much.
Who's next, Steve? We got LJ. LJ, good morning. What's on your mind, LJ? All right, well, we'll come back to LJ if we can.
Hi, I'm here.
LJ, hello. Hey, what's up?
Hi, how are you? I'm sorry.
Oh, no
problem.
Well,
thanks for the conversation. Okay, a couple of quick points, and I'll get off the phone. Joe brought up about Ronnie. I just wanted to remind folks that Ronnie kicked off his presidential campaign at the Neshoba County Fair, not too far from Philadelphia
Mississippi. Yeah.
Not too far from where the three civil rights workers, Cheney, Goodman, and
Schwarmer,
were murdered by the Klan.
Right. Yeah.
And Ronnie's message was states' rights. Ronnie's message was, I feel your pain, essentially. So I think that needs to be addressed. The second thing I'd like to bring up are the people that we used to refer to as the limousine liberals, who sip martinis in the West Hills and intellectualize about working class people who have who have never, ever worked up a sweat in their life. I used to be a cook. I worked 12 hours a day standing on my feet, sweating out a six-pack every shift. And then the ruling class elitists like Jeb, etc., are telling me I'm not working hard enough. When was the last time Jeb was a line cook? When was the last time Jeb drove a truck? When was the last time Jeb did any work at all? Except for the fact that I understand that when he was up at school, he was the premier marijuana dealer. Nickels, dimes, and joints. I understand.
I don't know if that's true or not. But, you know, Jeb's an aristocrat. And he probably worked hard executing all those people when he was governor of Florida. Imagine that was difficult.
And let's not forget, folks, that when he was governor of Florida, it was him who signed that bill about stand your ground.
That's right.
Thanks to Jeb, Trayvon is in the grave. And Zimmerman is walking around scot-free. And I think that's about all I want to say.
Okay, thanks a lot for the call.
Appreciate that.
Have a great day.
I don't want to make this into a conversation about Jeb Bush. I did want to seize on his comments that he made last week.
So I guess we can't talk about Trump either, then.
Yeah, well, we can, but let's...
I'm just being silly. Okay.
So there was a question earlier about Roger Ailes. He was a media consultant for Nixon, for Reagan, and for George Bush the Smarter. And for Rudy Giuliani when he first ran for mayor.
You know, for years I called him Giuliani.
Oh, really?
People would correct me, though.
Oh, yeah? But you were doing it on purpose, weren't you?
Yeah, I was. Yeah.
Okay, I want to throw a few more numbers at you because I really think they help tell the story of what we're trying to get across today. We talked about the enduring myth that if you cut taxes on the rich, we all do better.
Oh, yeah.
That ain't so. The highest marginal tax rates, and I want to explain briefly what marginal tax rates are, because this gets lost in this conversation much of the time. The highest marginal tax rate in the modern age in the United States was during World War II. It was about 94% on the very highest income earners. Now, does this mean that a multimillionaire in 1944 would have 94% of his money taken by the government? No, that's not what it means. It's a graduated marginal tax system that we have in this country. That means, let's say, Joe, that you earn $50,000 a year. And let's say that Bill Gates earns however many million dollars a year. Both of you are going to pay the same amount on that first $50,000 of income.
Mm-hmm.
Then Bill Gates is going to pay slightly more on, let's say, his next $50,000. He's going to pay a slightly higher rate. And on his next $100,000, he's going to pay a slightly higher rate. And on and on and on, such that at the end of his income, at that last million, that's going to be taxed at the highest rate. That's how that works. Those highest marginal rates in 1944 were about 94%. They came down in the immediate post-war era. They started to climb again towards the end of the 40s and into the 50s. They peaked again at about 91% under President Eisenhower, a rock-ribbed Republican, the supreme Allied commander in Europe. Not a blazing liberal by any stretch of the imagination. Still, the highest marginal rate was at 91%.
Mm-hmm.
So what did we do? What did the government do with this extra money that it had? It invested it in infrastructure. It put people to work. It built an interstate highway system. It built a public university system such the likes of which the world had never seen before. We put a man on the moon. We rebuilt our conquered enemies in Europe and in Japan. And on and on and on. We made robust investments in public infrastructure and in the welfare of Americans. And we have never been more economically solid than we were in those first 30, 40 years after the end of the Second World War.
It's true.
It's true. You can refute this false notion of trickle-down economics pretty easily.
Yeah, and it's also important to understand that in the struggle of World War II, if you were in any industry that had a defense relationship, you owned a business, you were on a cost-plus arrangement. That is to say, whatever it costs you to make a tank or an airplane or whatever, a gun, you could charge whatever it costs to make it, and then there was a percentage, typically 5%, which went directly to you. So there was no way you could lose.
No.
And that was pure profit. Which was taxed, as you suggest, at a marginal rate.
Indeed. And during the war, we had a special windfall profits tax that President Roosevelt enacted, or his Congress enacted, because it was considered immoral for anybody to profit excessively from a war, like the Second World War. We've thrown that out the window, too.
Oh, yeah.
It's now just fine to profit excessively from a foreign war.
And, in fact, we are a nation which Eisenhower, interestingly, in 1960 warned against, totally dependent economically on a military-industrial complex.
Indeed, yes. So let's take a moment and talk about the plight of the poor, overtaxed rich during this post-war period. Poor rich people, what happened to them, you might ask? Well, they stayed rich. They stayed rich, and they got even richer. Why? Because there was the aforementioned investment in infrastructure and in jobs and in education and in wages for working people. When more people have more money to spend, the economy does better and the wealthy do better, even though they're taxed at a higher rate. That's what's lost in this conversation. When the wealthy are taxed at a higher rate, they still do very, very well. End of story.
Really, let's go to the phones. I'd like to hear from some women. I'm becoming concerned that we are only hearing from one half of the population. 231-8187.
Richard, good morning.
Good morning. I understand that all you folks from Oregon who went to school here in Oregon have courses, 5 years of courses in constitutional studies. But I didn't go to school here, so I have a problem understanding the matter of taxes that you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And if you could help me understand the constitutional basis for taxation and the running of government and
I think you're setting a trap for us here, Richard.
Basically, the just what does the Constitution say about taxes?
I don't know. Will you tell us, Richard, what does the Constitution say about taxes?
Well, like I said, I'm not from Oregon. I didn't get 5 years of constitutional studies like everybody here did.
Why do you think people got 5 years of constitutional studies? Just to start out with that premise.
Because that's the law. That is the Oregon law at 336.057.
Richard, I think I know where you're going here.
057.
I think you're going to tell me that the Constitution, there is no constitutional basis for an income tax. Is that what you're going to tell me?
Oh, he left. Richard. Well, okay. Just to be clear, in fact, an amendment to the Constitution was made, I think 1913, which created the legitimacy of an income tax. So, you know, This is just a kind of an arcane argument.
It is, yeah. And a waste of our time.
Yes.
503-231-8187 is the number to call. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for a great dialogue and for taking my call. Governments need taxes so they can discharge their real responsibilities and protect the people, ensure for the common good and happiness. To me, the government is incompetent. It seems incapable of eliminating the cap on Social Security, which is at $118,000, and reducing working hours, and discovering justice in taxation. I hope you'll discuss the myths around taxation and regulation, how regulation has been demonized, how the top tax rate was actually over 70% from 1938 to 82, and how Reagan changed it from corporate to individual taxation and made us an overstressed people who don't know Canada from the moon.
I like that reference.
I uploaded an article, a translated article from an Austrian economist titled Reduced Working Hours as a Socioeconomic Investment. And this is, instead of seeing reduced working hours as a cost trap, it's very helpful to see it as an investment. He quotes a 1909 study which shows that reduced working hours increased productivity and increased output, and that people turn away from reduced working hours because they're kind of closed to the long-term necessities. They accept higher wages, instead of increased freedom, because they don't really understand the long-term effects of overlong work. I'm wondering if you can comment on that. And to me, reducing working hours and like creating community centers, as in Vancouver, Canada, is like a third way beyond the state and the market. And it would really be a new beginning, because the media and politics are hopelessly corrupt. The $76 billion from Walmart that's in Luxembourg and the Cayman Islands is just one a tipping point, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish it were a tipping point. Apparently, it just is taken as normal at this point. But I take your point, and I think it's really important to understand. What I think Abe and I both are arguing and are embedded in is the notion of social democracy. It's not about creating a model like the Soviet Union or China or someplace like that. It's about using what we now know about economics and about democracy in a manner that creates a system that gives people health care, that gives people housing, that gives people all those benefits and services that a government can, in fact, efficiently provide, at the same time that it allows for entrepreneurial capital to function. And this is something that's so far away from America, closer to places like France, and Sweden and Germany.
Denmark.
Yeah, and many other countries. Yeah. So it's entirely possible to do this. What is apparently impossible is to allow it to happen in the United States at this time in history.
And a big reason for that is the fact that the wealthy have become so unimaginably wealthy that it takes but a fraction of their resources to effectively purchase the machinery of government. By funding campaigns, you can make a relatively small investment, land you millions and millions of extra dollars if you're wealthy.
So the social state is not Bolshevism.
No.
But actually is the human future.
Yes.
Well, it should be the human future. I'm not sure. I have a very dark view, personally.
Why is it that we don't learn lessons from the 2007 financial crisis or the destruction of the Greek economy by the Troika, by austerity? Why is it the myths are so dominant? Is it because the media is corrupt?
And, well, partially. Certainly, that's true.
And simply makes alternatives and critical thinking taboo.
Well, let's quote Upton Sinclair for a moment. He said, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it." Yeah. So it's very difficult to convince the rich that this is the way to go when they're doing so freaking well the way things are now.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to understand who the media really is. Even the liberal media like MSNBC and so on really are not coming to grips with the fundamental issues. And we don't have we hardly have any print media left. But what we do have in the way of left-wing media is mostly magazines, and it's mostly seen and heard, noted by people like us, not by the majority of Americans. And most people no longer read to get their news. They, as I said earlier, particularly older Americans, are going to look at Fox News, where the pretty ladies talk gibberish and are essentially made to seem like they're supporting a patriotic notion of American capital.
I'd like just to make one comment on a German article discussing the origin of neoliberalism.
Uh-huh.
They point out that the Chamber of Commerce, back in 1972, actually had $900 million. And the membership, the number of firms, increased from 60,000 to a quarter of a million.
Mm-hmm.
And they, of course, began buying and developing think tanks and PR outfits. This is our context. And, of course, the mainstream in economics departments is wedded to the myths of trickle-down economics and demonizing regulation. But I just wanted to share that with you. I was amazed to learn that the Chamber of Commerce was so economically powerful back in 1972.
Well, in fact, what's happening all over the world right now is an extension of that of that philosophy, of the Chamber of Commerce philosophy.
Yes.
And we're seeing it. We're seeing it go on and on and on. What we're not hearing, what we're not understanding in the main media, to the degree that anyone even pays attention to it, is exactly where capitalism is headed. And what it looks like to me now is it's going to be an international cabal, really, where, as Abe suggested earlier, the American working class is going to be almost irrelevant. It won't have enough money to buy stuff. The markets will be in China and other places, India and so on. And at the same time, American labor will be marginalized more and more and not paid what labor ought to be paid, the European model notwithstanding.
Perhaps we can become cloud workers.
Ah, yes, cloud workers.
Yeah.
I always think of angels when I think of cloud workers.
Yes, thanks very
hey,
much.
Thank you for the call. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well,
it's not hard to see where our priorities lie as a nation. The fact is that wealth created by labor has now taken a backseat to wealth created by, and I use created very loosely here, by investment, by inheritance, by skimming the profit created by other people's labor.
Well, you know, now I have to mention Donald Trump.
No, you don't. You can hang on just a second.
Okay. Okay. I'll wait.
We tax money earned from investment at a lower rate than we tax money earned by wages.
That's true. I'm glad. You're
that,
right.
That is
That's
a
really
fundamental
important.
Truth that describes the reality of American priorities right now.
In other words, if you have a chunk of change and you throw it into a bank or into a stock exchange or whatever, you're taxed, the profit of that is taxed at a lower rate than a person who digs a ditch or drives a truck or operates a machine.
That's right. So when Jeb Bush says, well, those people should just work longer hours, well, you know what? He can kiss a certain body part.
I'm glad you backed away from that.
All right. So I'm going to read this here piece of paper, and then you can talk about Donald Trump, okay? Okay.
Are you going to allow me to talk
yes.
about Trump? Are you?
At 9, alternative radio, author and talk show host Tavis Smiley speaks on The Hidden Dr. King. At 10, both Air Cascadia and Flashpoints are off today. We'll hear Law and Disorder. Professor Stephen Salaita discusses his new position at the American University of Beirut, as well as his lawsuit against the University of Illinois for withdrawing a job offer over his support for Palestinian human rights. Also, National Herald columnist Dan Georgiakis explains the ongoing negotiations over Greece's debt and status in the Eurozone. At 11, Stage and Studio presents a special documentary, The Illumination of Rumi, with Michael Green, author of a book by the same name. And at 11:30, Art Focus host Joseph Gallivan interviews Nicole Nathan and Namita Wiggers of the Museum of Contemporary Craft about the state of Oregon craft and their travels around Oregon in search of crafts that use local materials and represent their communities. All that and more coming up on KBOO.
Yeah, you know, we have, I want to just emphasize this, we have the best in public affairs programming and also incredibly good music programming here.
And no Roger Ailes.
Oh, I miss him.
I do.
Yeah, really.
All right, talk to us about Donald Trump.
Well, I don't want to spend a lot of time on him, but I think it's really amazing, just amazing, that this guy is able to be an outrageous, essentially a racist and nationalist, and get a lot of press. And what he says really feeds a vast army of enormously ignorant people. The whole concept of the United States as a nation of immigrants is ignored. The whole concept of how we got a large part of Mexico in a war in the 1840s is ignored. The whole reality of the situation in terms of the fact that right now there's very few people entering the U.S. illegally for work. Where there is a problem is in the entering of narcotics, serious narcotics.
And Canadians, man. All those Canadians coming over the
border.
Yeah,
rushing in. And the fact of the matter is that if Americans weren't so into bad drugs, there'd be no market, and all of that would disappear.
True.
So, anyway, and Trump, you know, I want to know where that hair came from.
I don't want to know.
You don't care. You
don't care. Don't know. Don't care.
All right.
These priorities that I was talking about just a moment ago, the way yes. that ownership is prioritized over labor, the way that investment income is prioritized over labor income, it's reflected throughout U.S. policy and in policies that touch all parts of our lives. For example, only 8 other nations in the country don't require any sort of paid vacation each year for their citizens. Now, there's a lot of employers in this country that offer paid vacation, but it's not required by law. Only five other countries besides the United States, or in addition to the United States, don't require paid maternity leave or paternity leave.
Well,
all the other nations of the world give new mothers and fathers at least some time off to spend with their newborn child. Well, not the United States of America.
Well.
Well, what? Well,
why are people having babies? They shouldn't have babies.
Well, that's right. Not if they can't afford it.
Yeah, really.
Not if it means they have to take time off work.
Oh, yeah.
They should just not have sex. That's for rich people.
Sex is for rich people.
Sex is for rich people.
Okay.
So here's what this really comes down to in my mind. When you hear conservatives object to having taxes raised on the wealthy and so on, they often talk about how that's just redistribution of wealth. Well, yes, yes, it is. That's what governments do. They tax citizens, and they take that money, and they spend it on other things, whether it's fighting fires or waging wars or providing health care or public education or paving roads and on and on and on. All governments redistribute wealth. It's just a question of how and to whom that wealth is being redistributed. Conservatives, when they complain about this, usually it's because they feel that their money, which it really isn't, is being redistributed to the wrong sorts of people. And surprise, surprise, the wrong sorts of people usually tend to be A, poor, and B, not white.
Well, you're
that's
right.
What the objection to redistribution means.
Yeah, and I think one of the most bizarre aspects of all of this is the degree to which this ideology has been embedded in the American culture. And I remember it from my childhood, from my years in grade school and high school. Essentially, we were being taught the very ideology that now has become the reality, the dominant reality of the discussion, of the paradigm, as it were, of American capitalism.
Yeah, you were provided a capitalist education.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah.
You're right. I think a lot of this stuff has been internalized by the American working public. I have some more statistics that are pretty telling here.
Go for it.
22% of Americans are expected to check their email by their employers even when they're not at work. Half of Americans voluntarily check their work email over the weekend, feeling that they somehow need to, that they're obligated to, that this leisure time they're enjoying is somehow time stolen from the workplace, from their employer. 46% of Americans check their work email even when they're homesick. 34% check it while they're on vacation. We have so internalized this notion that it is our duty to get it out there and work, work, work to the enrichment of our bosses that we even fail to enjoy the what little time we do have to ourselves.
It's scary. It is actually very, very scary. And what that does in a larger cultural sense is it focuses our lives and our leisure time included in a concern for income and in a concern for serving a master.
Right. And it's status. Let's not forget that we are bombarded every day by images and messages telling us how we should look, what we should wear, what we should be into, what music we should listen to, what car we should drive, where we should live, where we should go on vacation, and on and on and on and on.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones. Who do we have, Steve? BT, good morning.
Good morning, Abe and Joe.
Good morning.
Yeah, you know, I really need to call in to bring you guys down to earth a little each time. Let me try to get back to your topics. You know, you're talking about myths. Now, you just made a passing comment about the Laffer curve, and mm-hmm. People ridicule that too often. Now, Laffer did not say that lowering taxes brings more revenue. That's not what the Laffer curve says. He said that there's an optimum point, and of course, it could actually change every day. And even if you can't, no one can find it. It exists. So he would say, you know, you're taxing, let's say, the general population in total.
Mm-hmm.
You go beyond it. You start at zero. Zero tax rate. Obviously, the government is bringing in zero from an income tax. That is, and then as you raise taxes, you're bringing in a lot, and you reach a point where you're getting less because you're taking so much that maybe people will work less, stop less, jobs disappear, you can't figure it out.
So you're saying, Laffer posited a sweet spot, a taxation sweet spot.
He said that there is a sweet spot. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that everybody like me says that it should be at the sweet spot, because I agree. There's one guy who once said, he said, if lowering taxes brings in more revenues, then you're not lowering them enough. But that's just another story. And then, of course, about the Republicans, I'll be the first one to admit that the Republicans, for too many years, it seems like their sole economic plank is lowering taxes. It's like they've got it conditioned
yes,
into
right.
it's that. But to me, I'm interested in it goes deeper than that. For instance, I'm interested in all kinds of laws, regulations, codes, and everything that prevent jobs from being created, even by small entrepreneurs creating their own. And there was a time in this country when the Supreme Court, or federal courts, even state courts, did a better job at protecting, the right to work, the right to make an honest living. And what happened some years ago, some decades ago, and I hate to say it might have something to do with the centralizing of the courts, a lot of court decisions, where they were beginning to tell the states and say, hey, you're violating this guy's right to work. They started to let the states do their own thing, like saying, hey, who are we to interfere with a state legislature that has, kicked this issue around? So one example would be, for instance, an issue that I'm interested in lately is casket sales, where I found out a few years ago that many states have these laws that you can't sell caskets. And usually someone who wants to enter into that business get a storefront, and it's the same caskets that the funeral parlors sell, but they sell them for maybe a third of the price. So obviously that's helping the consumer, usually lower income people that might have to buy just one or two coffins in their lives. They don't want to spend $5,000, they'd rather spend two. And they find out that the state will shut them down, not even let them start, because they have codes, including you cannot sell coffins unless you go to school to learn how to be a mortician, and then you have to work as an apprentice for a couple of years. Now, of course, that kind of business, those businesses never start. Now, I'd like to ask you, why would, do you think that in order to sell a casket, someone should learn how to do any embalming, which he's never going to do? All he's going to do is sell caskets.
I don't know the answer to that, and I'm not sure why we're talking
courts,
about it.
The courts used to throw that kind of stuff out, but they've been, just protecting it. I don't want to say, oh, look, who are we? And, of course, most people don't know that kind of stuff exists, but that's the kind of thing that causes people to spend more money on things.
Yeah, but what you're talking about is literally a part of a micro system of power.
Yeah, okay, Joe, but that's what I'm saying. I said that's what the Republicans or people who are interested in commerce, they're not really concentrating on that. They just let that go, and all they talk about is, oh, elect me and I'll cut taxes. See, they're just down to that one issue, and that's
true.
The stupidity I'm talking about.
Yeah, I see your point, but it's pretty obscure
in the
context of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
I want to do, real quickly, I just want to announce that I've been asked to announce this. There is going to be this Wednesday, July 15th at 9:30, peaceful gathering at the City Hall to protest what I believe to be a waste of public monies to spend a lot of money on essentially burying the water system, which will lead to increased radon and more danger of contamination of the water system. It's a bureaucratic system, a bureaucratic device that essentially aids a powerful interest group, the Water Bureau crowd, and the various associated industries. And I've been horrified by this. As you know, I've done several shows on this. But, if you're free on Wednesday at 9:30, go down to City Hall and really protest this incredible waste of money that is being done by the city.
All right. That's all.
I just wanted to get that out there.
BT, our last caller, mentioned something interesting, and that is that Republican politicians seem to call for tax cuts no matter what's going on. For example, when George Bush the Dumber was first elected, the economy was doing pretty well after the Clinton years were over. So he said, the economy's doing well, let's cut taxes and give money back to people because it's their money anyway. And then when the economy tanked, the same remedy was proposed by conservative politicians. Things are really bad. you've got to cut taxes, particularly on the wealthy, because they'll create more jobs. So that's the it's a universal cure-all if you're a conservative. Cut taxes when the times are good and cut taxes when times are bad.
Well, I mean, the advocacy of reduction of taxes for the rich has been a constant theme in American history, really.
It has.
And we're seeing it over and over again. Hey, we're running out of time.
We are out of time.
I hope you enjoyed the conversation. I hope you'll stay tuned to KBOO. And we'll be back next week.
If you didn't manage to get through by phone today, you can still leave a comment on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Abe and Joe. And we'll be back at you next week.
Okay, stay tuned for the best in music and public affairs.
On Tiananmen Square. It's coming from the feel that this ain't exactly real, or it's real, but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Should it be harder for landlords to evict their tenants for no reason at all?
Should safe and healthy homes come before the interests of private investment?
Is the rent too damn high?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, join us for the next Portland Renters Assembly.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right.
The next two assemblies are on Sunday, July 12th, from 12 to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library, with speakers on how race intersects with gentrification.
And on Wednesday, July 15th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park, with speakers on community organizing and mobilizing.
Tell your story and join the conversation. For more information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.
And good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. It's 9 o'clock. Here's what's coming up this morning on KBOO. First, on alternative radio, author and talk show host Tavis Smiley speaks on The Hidden Dr. King. At 10, both Air Cascadia and Flashpoints are off today. We'll hear Law and Disorder. Professor